The song we just heard was Do You Still Love Me, the first single from singer-songwriter Ryan Adams' new album, Prisoner. Ryan, welcome to the music show on RN.
Thanks for having me.
I've only had a couple of listens so far to Prisoner, and to me it feels like a real part two to your 2014 album, Ryan Adams. Mm. It's got such a big sound. It's got this beautiful 80s muscular guitar-y sound. There's even a sax in there, which is a kind of a rare thing in a Ryan Adams song. And it's almost theatrical, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about, as you describe it, the sonic geography of where this album came from.
Well, first of all, thank you for saying that about it being connected to the last record. I feel the same way. I produced both those albums, so that's a big part of it. And also Charlie Stavish, who's the guy that plays bass in my band, and or I should say I play guitar and sing in his band. He also has engineered and been part of my life and record-making process all the way back to Easy Tiger. I met him before that record, actually. He lived in New York and worked at Electric Lady, and he's the first guy that I think I really started to gel with in a way where I could record, and he and I had stuff in common that we didn't really have to say, things about like liking drums to push air and feel compressed in 70s, but big guitars and things like that. And I think that an interesting thing is that on my way towards, you know, being somebody that owned a studio that wanted to have vintage gear and analog gear and then also be able to capture real performances, there was also that awakening in myself of what it felt like to be someone that could just play an entire set on an acoustic guitar. And then also what it felt like for me to go back to the electric guitar and what were those things that made me who I was. And I think a lot of that, besides the emotional and the intellectual aspects of the songs themselves that glue records together for me, I entered to this phase after Ashes and Fire, or during Ashes and Fire, where I didn't feel like I had anything to lose anymore at all by not just being exactly what I wanted to be, which was not like my records. It wasn't that my records were not me. It's that I always liked the challenge of having a producer, working with someone that was challenging or maybe taking on more of a bigger concept or a process than I might be able to achieve. Working with Glenn on Ashes and Fire was great, and the band that was called together for that and the things I learned from Glenn were incredible. He's an unbelievable guy to work with. And in terms of, you know, watching somebody create sonic geography, I mean, that guy is like...
He's a legend.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, he's like Galileo. What's interesting about Glenn, and for people that don't know about recording, is on a recording console, most engineers or producers, they're usually both, and they use almost all or as much of the recording console as they can, and a lot of the things that the recording console can do, like compress a signal or affect it or EQ it, and Glenn uses as little of the board as possible and almost nothing but an LA-2A compressor. It's literally the way that he uses the microphone. It's unbelievable and very beautiful and very pure. And he does not like to exaggerate the ability of the performer. And I think that that's incredible. It's as though he's recording a classical music album. And if that's the way you play drums, that's the way it went down. So working with him on that record was great in that I just played acoustic guitar and sang. I added a few things later, but he really wanted me to be in that room with, you know, these musicians, and I picked some and he picked some, and it was like we were picking some kind of a football team, and then we went out and played the game. And after all that was said and done and I had built my studio, I just sort of felt like, you know, there's a certain kind of guitar, there's a certain sort of feel on guitar, there's a certain kind of way that I perform when I'm not making records that are for sale. And it appealed to me to find a way to capture this missing and hidden thing that I've been hinting at for so long, which is like a kind of a combination of things. It's a combination of, you know, the elements of Bob Mould's guitar playing and Husker Du and the chorus pedal effect that you hear on that, and its relationship also to the same kinds of sounds that, although Bob is playing very fast and he's articulate and the guitar's open, I would hear the same sorts of clean guitar lines and all kinds of other records. from, you know, Simple Minds to Tears for Fears, even like Scritti Politti, stuff that most people wouldn't register as something that I might be into. And then also when I record typically for my whole life, since I was growing up, there weren't enough musicians around. So it was usually me and my friend Alan, who's now passed away, but back when I was growing up, he would play drums, I'd play acoustic guitar and sing, and we record one track into a four track, and it left me three tracks. So when I played bass, I could sing the background vocal at the same time. It left me a guitar track that could be open that I might be able to play guitar on the verse and then switch quickly to the piano with one mic. And that sort of stuff really appealed to me, and I wanted to get closer to that. And what I found out slowly as I did that on the last record and then on this record is that at the end result of that is that my music has more in common with all those things and none of those things than I thought.
Mm. Jumping around a bit, I mean, last year people were hearing your rather extraordinary cover of the Taylor Swift album, and I know you talked about that a lot, but what did you come away with having done that exercise? Did you learn different stuff about your approach to how you perform and write songs from covering a whole album of somebody else's work?
You know, I think that from my perspective, it's very different because when I say I have my own studio, it sounds like I have like a studio where other people can pay for time and record there, but it's not professional studio in that respect, but it is very professional in that it's like a museum and stuff always stays set up in my place. And in Los Angeles, there aren't many places, or I haven't seen many places where you could just call people up and jam.
And that's kind of how the Taylor Swift thing was born, yeah?
The interesting part of it is it's not different in any way to how things normally happen at my studio. It was another in a long series of things that happened there. And of course, the attention on what it was changed dramatically, I think, because, you know, she has such a huge audience and she has the world's ear. And for someone with that kind of success and for someone with that kind of popularity, in my experience, it's unusual how well adjusted and unaffected by that she is. And so, of course, when she sort of responded to the fact that I was doing it, it kind of sent extra energy towards the project.
Yeah.
And I think I felt, as did my friends, we loved doing it. I don't think I could have ever have predicted that it would have gotten any of the attention or response that it did. And I love the fact that it was inspiring to people because the world is pretty dark. There's a lot of stuff happening. There's a lot of people. There's a lot of discourse. There's a lot of reasons to be afraid. And there's a lot of reasons for people to feel disenfranchised about life and art. And listening to beautiful music that was made to inspire people and learning it and being like a 40-year-old man and learning these songs to learn something new and then sharing that process with people felt so beautiful to me and it felt right.
It's a great gift.
Yeah. It wasn't in any way like some kind of a, there wasn't an end result in mind.
It wasn't premeditated at all.
No, only that I had run that day and said, why don't we try this?
Yeah.
And then as it sort of escalated into what it was, there was only one moment of pause where I went, should I let this happen? And honestly, like the conversations that I had with Taylor were like, I really hope people can hear this. It's so cool because she was hearing the clips, but I wasn't sharing the whole songs with anyone.
Yeah.
And I basically said, you know, look, I'll let you listen to it first when it's done and then you can do with it whatever you want. Like, I just want to make it. I mean, it created a conversation that was so outside of what we did that was polarizing and really interesting. And I learned so much just watching all of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. You're talking about this, though, reminds me of something I feel about your music a lot, which is you mentioned, you know, influences like Scritti Politti or Johnny Marr and Smiths and, you know, Husker Du. And yet there's this amazing thing that happens with your music where all these influences go in and they kind of get ground down into the cauldron and they come out with this very specific Ryan Adams sound.
Mm.
And I'm wondering, like, are you aware of that sound? Do you know what your imprint is that you put on music, because that's how I felt about the Taylor Swift stuff. I'd heard some of it on the radio. I liked it. It was great pop. It's some great lyrics in there. But it came out sounding like something that came from you.
And anything and everything that's something that you're listening to, that's whether you're listening to it as a fan or listening to it as a guitar player or whatever, I suppose is going to become something that's imprinted in what I do. But most of what my playing and writing is instinctual. So I don't know if it's directly influenced. I don't know if it's something that that I'm making intentionally or not, because I don't really invite critical processes into what I make. I think that's why 1989 happened. It's like I just wanted to go play with my music with my friends, and it turned out that that was extremely cathartic because I had a lot on my mind, and it was actually probably easier for me at the end, without knowing it, to let that stuff free in that jam zone with those guys doing these cool Taylor songs. It really, it really allowed me a moment to really like just let myself loose. When I saw some of the pushback, I remember thinking like, wow, it's a mirror. It's you who's critical.
Yeah.
Because I just made something for fun.
And you're reading all this stuff into it. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is pretty wild.
Can we talk a little bit about producing? I mean, you talked beautifully about working with Glenn. And I know over the last couple of years, as you say, the last two albums of yours, you've produced yourself. And you can hear it. There's a self-knowledge in them, no question. It's a different kind of sound, I think. But at the same time, you've also been producing other artists, you know, like Willie Nelson and Fall Out Boy and Jenny Lewis. Mm. Why did you want to stop working with other producers? And what do you learn about your own music from working with other artists?
The way I look at it is, if I'm going to work with a band or an artist, and that's something that's going to happen at my studio, it's going to be because they wanted to do it. I very rarely am going to chase someone down to do it. Once in a while, I might hear someone and think, gosh, they sound so great live. I wish they just recorded to tape. Or what would this sound like with less overdubs or without Pro Tools? The point of my studio, typically, if it's for another artist, is to not be in a computer and to just use 2-inch tape. I just think it helps boost the end result is to boost the confidence of the writer, performer, and the band themselves. Because I think that without people realizing it, the digital technology that we are using to try to communicate with each other better is dehumanizing us. The subtext of having a telephone that you communicate with by text message, or that you then have a computer that links up to it where you can record your music in, the subtext of all that is that all information is reviewable later, which I think is really extremely negative. Mm. It doesn't allow for an impression or a shadow. It's hard to get misty about a conversation with someone and remember the impact or the tone of it if it's reviewable.
Absolutely.
And also,
something about the way memory works, yeah.
Yeah, and also it causes people, I think, to unnecessarily hold themselves and other people accountable in a way that they shouldn't, which is really unfortunate, I think. I mean, there used to be a time when people would say things because they felt like the conversation was open, or they would commit things to letter because it meant that much to them. Mm. And when you take away that space in between, you end up with stuff that's really noise. I don't know how or if or when, at least the people from my generation, will be able to discern the differences between recording into a computer, which can show you the sound wave and you can isolate parts that are not perfect. Mm. And very easily, there are things inside to bend them, to make them be note perfect or time perfect. And it's so understood now and so much easier for even rock bands to kind of go, well, that eighth note was out a little bit, or that background vocal was out a little bit. But then all these same people, they admire classic rock records.
Which are full of mistakes.
Yeah, or even like...
And recorded live.
Yeah, I'm always shocked by this, but it's like the classic rock or 80s stations or oldie stations, when you listen to those recordings, they're so beautiful. And people always go like, oh God, like that's the best music ever. That's so classic. I love it. I love those old Rolling Stones records, and you go like, there are wrong notes on those records, but they're not wrong. They're felt, and it's blues records, all kinds of records.
The mistakes make them.
Yeah, and there's not like some horrible out of place note, but you know there are things that are a little pitchy. Like I always like to think about R.E.M. I go like, really go listen to like that song for the one I love, or even their first really big hits. Like there's a human voice there, and it's at play, and those notes bend. And nowadays, engineers are trained, or they're very typically, they go in and they find those moments and they flatten
and
them.
Fix them all up.
Yeah. And then you go see the person live, or that person himself will go to play live and they will feel dissatisfaction. So as a producer, for me, I want to try to find something in a person that's already there and to sort of secure it, kind of to subtly tell the person that I'm recording, like, you are enough as you are right now.
Ryan Adams, thank you very much for joining us on The Music Show.
Thanks for having me. So